This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. If you are a listener always, thank you for being here once again. And if you're new here, welcome to the podcast for the very first time. I'm glad that you decide to join and listen in. If you are in any kind of danger of violence, domestic violence, or anything of the sort, please do not listen to this podcast. Hang up, dial 911. I'm going to give you a quick trigger warning. This podcast is going to be triggering for some people. If you need any assistance with domestic violence, there is a national domestic violence hotline number. It is 1-800-799-7233. Again, the number is 1-800-799-7233. They have a lot of really good information, and I think that if you are a victim of domestic violence or you're just surviving and you need some help, it would be a great place to go. Today's guest is Miss Kathy Kleiner. For all of you in the world that doesn't know this lady, she is a Ted Bundy survivor. She survived Ted Bundy, and she is a breast cancer survivor. She is also a lupus survivor. And today she is going to talk about her survival skills and what she's learned about herself and what she does to survive and continue thriving through everything. So if Miss Kathy Kleiner gives me permission, we are going to start recording.
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. Kathy, I'm going to let you have the floor. And I know this is a little nerve-wracking because I'm like, I don't edit the podcast. So, Kathy's going to talk about virtually surviving everything that she's went through. So if you want to start with whenever you want to start, that's great. I'll let you.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much for inviting me to be able to talk to your audience today. Sure. I'm very humbled that I get to tell my story, and I appreciate and thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I have, I've dealt with a lot, and I'll go through it with y'all. My survivor skills have been one where I'm able to talk about things. Now, today, when I speak to you, it's a healing process for me. It's a way I have gone through things by facing them head on and talking about it. And it is one thing that has helped me to get through a lot of the, a lot of the stuff. If I get too emotional, I'm sorry. It's just, I try to go into the situation as I'm telling you so you can truly feel how I felt at that time. I was born in Miami. At the age of 5, my daddy died, and he was my world. Every evening, he'd come home, and we'd play Chinese checkers together. It was a very hot little house with no air conditioning. And one day, I'm looking out the window and saying, Mama, you know, where's Daddy? And everything she's going through, she said, Daddy's not coming home anymore, honey. He's up in heaven with Grandma. And I'm like, okay. And it's something I didn't understand, but it changed my world at that point. And I just had to go on and know, okay, well, my reality is different now because Daddy's not in it. A couple years later, my mama remarried, and I was adopted by my stepfather, who was wonderful. He was my daddy, and I loved him to death, and he was everything to me as well. He passed on a couple years ago. But he was my rock doing a lot of the things that I have been through. When I was 13, I was diagnosed with systemic lupus erythematosus. That is a form of lupus that not only attacks your system and your blood, white count and red count, it also attacks your organs. In my situation, it attacked my kidney. I was in the hospital for 3 months. Back when I was 13 in the 70s, lupus wasn't a well-known disease. They hadn't seen it in children, so I was not diagnosed for about 3 months that I was in the hospital. And this was a weird time for me. I didn't want this to be normal now. You know, I wanted to get out, I wanted to play, but I felt so sick. I was so sick. And my parents were told that I was so grave condition that I would probably not live through the next year. Again, they didn't know exactly what was wrong with me or how to treat me. My doctor told my mama, there was a Cuban doctor in Miami who had an experimental form of chemo, and she wanted to see if it, you know, would be something that would help me. So my mama agreed, and I took the chemo, and I lost all my hair. I'm 13, I have no hair, and I'm sick all the time in bed, and I'm just like wishing to give up. But I'm not. I'm not. I wanted to get better. I wanted to feel good and go out. So seventh grade, I was homebound. I could not leave the house for any reasons. My teacher came in and gave me homebound schoolwork. And I did that. And mom and daddy worked. And I was so lonely. And just when I did feel good, I remember going to the phone and dialing zero, so I could talk to the operator, just because I wanted someone to talk to. And it's these little things I remember that kind of popped up and said, you know, I'm going to be okay. Toward the end of the year of my seventh grade, I talked my mom and daddy into letting me go out for the first time. And we went to church. I knew mama would go for that one. So went to church and went and had ice cream afterwards. And I was all dressed up in my my scarf on my head and my pretty dress. And I was just so happy. And not 2 weeks later after that, I came down with shingles. So I'm pretty puny, and I have shingles that were on my face and my neck. And it was a hard time for me. Toward the summer, it was getting to be summer, I really started feeling better. I was able to go outside and just do things, not have the energy to play, but at least I was outside and life was turning good again. I said, okay, this is it. I'm turning the corner. But my hair was growing in slowly, and I didn't know people or students now because I'd been home when everyone was going to middle school. So I missed that experience, and people didn't know me very well. When I started high school, I was a freshman. I couldn't do physical activity. First off, it could cause the lupus to reactivate and to come back. And also, I just didn't have the energy. I went and joined theater. So for 4 years, I was in theater, and it was wonderful. I found an outlet where I could just be me, I could act, and I could do and be anyone that I had to be or wanted to be, except that sick little kid that was home in sixth grade. I didn't have to be her anymore, and I knew life was out there and things were going to be good because I had fun things to look forward to. I met a lot of good friends when I was in high school. And actually, I met my husband I'm married to now. We never dated back then, but we're good friends. I met some good friends that I'll talk about again soon in my life. But this is good. Life's great. I want this to be my new normal. I want this to be what life's about. And I had to work for it, though. It didn't come knocking on my door. I had to find the door to open it in order to get through this, through all of this. So I think that's one of my coping mechanisms, is I'm not going to sit in a little box with no windows. I'm going to open the door and see what's on the other side. And like I said, I face everything and I talk about it, and it heals me. I don't just crawl into myself and hide it. After high school, I decided where to go for college. A lot of my friends were going to different colleges in Florida. My best friend, Betsy, actually was going to go to FSU along with some other kids. So Florida State University. I decided to go there, not for the academics or what I could achieve there. I chose Florida State because it was as far away from Miami as I could get and still pay in-state tuition. So that was my big decision on choosing which school to go to. I was so excited to go to college. Mama was real protective of me because of lupus, and she just wanted to keep me in her little bubble and make sure nothing happened to me. I got to college, and it was great, and Mom and Daddy moved me into a dormitory, which was a all-women. It was an all-woman dorm, and my friends all lived in the co-ed dorm, so I would go and visit them a lot. But it was a good experience to get out and have some freedom in my dormitory. But we used to, it was all women. And I remember when they had panty raids, the first and second floor, guys could go up. But on the third floor, no guys were ever allowed. I remember when there were panty raids downstairs, the girls and I would throw our panties over the stairwell so they fell all the way down, and we giggle, oh, we had a panty raid. We were throwing the panties down. So, but it was fun. That, you know, that was life then. And, you know, as a young person just opening their wings and looking out in the world, this was a good place for me. I enjoyed it. As a freshman, I decided to join a sorority. When you do this in as a freshman in college, it's called RUSH. What RUSH is when one of the students or the women who are freshmen in the college decide that they want to join a sorority. So there's a week where the sorority teach, I'm sorry, there's a week where the sisters meet up with the women. We have like 15 minutes and we talk, and they get to talk to us, and then we move to the next house sorority, and they talk to us again. So we can choose about 5 sorority houses we would want to go through that week, and kind of just get to know each of the sisters a little bit better and the sorority as a group. As I decided which Chi-O I wanted to join was the best decision. Chi Omega was my sorority of choice. One of the girls I knew from high school and theater was Susie White. Susie was also a Chi-O, so with her recommendations and her talking about me, Chi-O thought we would be a good fit. So that's how I chose to go to Chi Omega as a sorority. When I was a freshman, beside my basic classes I took, I remember I took archaeology. I wanted to be a famous archaeologist and find, you know, the new discover something new. And we'd be on a field class, and I remember I playing in the dirt and I broke one of my fingernails, and I thought, okay, this is too physical work for me, I can't do this. So I decided I needed something else to go into. My freshman year up to the fall of 76 up to the summer of 77, I decided to come home, and I wanted to go back to Florida State in the fall of 77. My parents did not like me living in the dorm. They thought it was too potentially bad for me, that people could come in or someone could hurt me. They made arrangements for me to live in the Chi Omega house. That was something. There were about 80 girls that were Chi Omegas, and about 40 got to live in the sorority house. It was a beautiful, big Victorian home, and it was a great, great space. We had a house mama that lived in an apartment there, so we were well supervised, and mama's daddy said, this is where I want her. So they made arrangements for me to move in there in the fall of 77. I moved in, and I was so excited. Here I was, a new Chi-O sister, and living in the house and taking classes, and life was good again. And I just wanted it to keep going forever. When I moved into my room in Chi-O, it was kind of bare. My roommate and I decided how we wanted to decorate it. So Christmas came, in the December of 77, and Mom and I went out and we picked the best bedspread I could find. We looked forever for that, but that was my pride and joy, was my bedspread. We come up now to January 1978. On the 14th of January, the night before, the day before I was attacked, it was a beautiful, sunny, cold day in Tallahassee. In Tallahassee, I remember it was drizzly and cold, and I put on my big woolly sweater and my blue corduroy pants, and I was ready to go out and see what the day brought us. Actually, I also had a wedding that I had to go to at noon that day. So a bunch of us guys got together and we did something before the wedding. We had the wedding. It was very small and just very intimate and just a nice time to be together. And now I had my friends at church as along with my friends from sorority. So it was a good mix for me. After the wedding, we went to the reception at a hotel in Tallahassee, and it was great. We got all the food and all the booze we could drink at the reception. And being college kids, it was great. We didn't have to scrounge for liquor and food, so we enjoyed that. Later that afternoon, I went home to the Cayo house. It was a couple blocks from the church. We were going to all go out and go to a movie that night, the kids from the wedding. So I went home back to the sorority to change. When I walked in, there were all these girls, sorority sisters, talking in the hallway of what they did and what they were going to do. And I decided that I wanted just to stay home that night. So instead of going out, I went up to my bedroom, which was on the second floor of the sorority. We faced the back parking lot, which was the back of the house. My room was the second floor, and it was the second room on the left. When you walked into my bedroom, I had green carpet. On each side of the wall of the door were our closets. And then as you look further down the room on the wall, it was my dresser and then my desk and then my bed. And my bed faced the back of the room. So the back wall of the room was completely windows. It was a beautiful sunshiny room, and we always kept our curtains open because we hung plants on the rods, so the sunroom was always sunny and bright. I decided to stay home. I put on my pajamas, crawled into bed, and decided to study. That was about 8:30 that night. Around 11:30, my roommate and I decided to go to sleep. She also was studying in her room. So we decided to go to sleep. It was about 11:30 on that Saturday night. I sleep pretty light, and I was sleeping on my side. And really early in the morning, I wasn't sure what time it was, I heard our bedroom door open, and it slid across the carpet that was the green carpet it slid across. And it kind of woke me up a little bit because it was an unusual sound. It wasn't loud, but it was something that kind of made me wake up. The next thing I heard was a big thug and noise and something being kicked. And what that was, a small footlocker that Karen and I had between our twin beds. So there were maybe 3 feet on each side of the footlocker until our twin beds. So there wasn't a lot of room, and the room was dark at that point, being so early in the morning. Whomever came into our room had knocked that over, had kicked that trunk, and it made so much noise that now I am waking up. And I'm squinting my eyes, and I'm trying to focus, and what was I looking at? And all I could see was a silhouette, a figure of someone standing next to me. And as I was looking and squinting, I saw this person raise his arm up over his head. And I could tell there was something in his hand, but I didn't know what it was. And it seemed in slow motion that he took his arm and slammed it on my face with what turned out to be a oak club piece of firewood. When he hit me, it didn't hurt right away. It was like a thud. It was just a weird sensation. And I broke my jaw in three places. It slammed my chin so bad it shattered. I almost broke my tongue off. My cheek was open from the corner of my mouth up to my ear, and it had bark inside. It was embedded in my cheek, and it flipped open so you could see the inside of my mouth. My shoulder was lacerated also with the oak club that he hit me with. At this point, I kind of went out. I became unconscious for a few minutes. And as I was, sometime during that time, my roommate started to stir, hearing the noise that was going on. So this person went over to her and attacked her and hit her with the same piece of firewood that he had attacked me. I'm now moaning and groaning, and I'm hurting. And the pain is so fierce in my head and my shoulder, and it just, I can't explain the pain. It was horrible. And I'm in a little ball, and I'm small as I could make myself, and I'm screaming, but no sound is coming out. And I looked, and I opened my eyes a little bit, and this person was standing next to me again, and he raised his arm. And I thought for sure I was going to die. I thought for sure this was it. And as he stood there, before he hit me again, the room, it illuminated with a bright light. And it was bright in there. And I'm opening my eyes now, and I see this person who's dressed all in dark clothes, kind of spooked. He was antsy. He was looking out the window and looking at me. And he finally ran out the door. And then the room got dark again. And I'm in my little huddle in my bed. And it occurred to me that light was the light of a car that was bringing one of the sorority sisters home from a date that night. So when that light shone into our room, it made this person trip over that trunk again and run out the door. And after the room got dark, I still expected him to come back and attack me again. I was so overwhelmed in pain and being scared that I just passed out. Excuse me. The next thing I remember was a police officer, and he was standing next to my head and talking to me. And when I saw him, I felt such a comfort because I knew I was going to be safe. That guy wasn't going to come hit me anymore, that the police were going to take care of me, and I was safe. Although I'm in a world of confusion and hurt, that little piece, that little sliver, made me feel safe inside. After a while, I'm screaming in the top of my lungs for someone to help me, and all I was doing was making gurgling sounds because of my jaw being broken so severely. And my tongue almost sheared off. It's all I can do. My face is all swollen now. And that was very hurtful because I wanted to scream and yell, and I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I remember the EMS came next. And they were so sweet to me. And they took care of me. And they did see the bark that was in my face. And it was cluttered on the floor and on my bed. So that's how they knew it was that piece of oak that he carried in with him. They tended to me and stabilized me enough that they could carry me out of the sorority house on the stretcher. When you walked into the sorority, into the foyer, there was this beautiful wooden staircase that went up to the second floor where I lived. I'm now being carried down those stairs on a stretcher. And I start to go outside the big double doors, and it's so cold, and I'm freezing, and I'm hurting, and I'm scared. And a little bit later, a couple feet later, I see the lights from the sirens and the motor and the ambulance and the police cars, and all the noise was squeaking from the walkie-talkies, and in my mind, I was in a carnival. My mind took me to somewhere that was safe And actually, I wanted to go there. It was something, a fond memory of being in a carnival. And I had that thought for a few minutes until I was taken into the ambulance. And once again, the police officer never left me. He was right by my head the whole time. And I was taken into the ambulance and then taken to the hospital at Tallahassee Memorial Hospital.
And we are at the 24-minute mark. So I think I'm going to stop the recording and we're going to take a quick recess. And then I want you to come back and we'll talk more about this.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, me and Kathy are back. She's going to finish telling you about her experience. So go ahead, Kathy.
I was attacked by Ted Bundy on the night and the morning of January 15th, 1978. After the traumatic experience I had in the sorority house, I was taken to Tallahassee Memorial Hospital, where I was taken to the ER and into the OR. They wired my mouth shut as best they could. They put they wired it as far as my teeth wired together, and they had the lacerations on my shoulder and some other injuries they tried to take care of. About a week later, I left the hospital and was flown back down to Miami, where my parents lived. And that's where I was going to recuperate. That's where I was going to get better and get through this. Because once again, I decided, you know, this is not going to define me. I'm not going to live like that little girl in my house all year. I wasn't going to live being a victim of this attack. I was recuperating in Miami. It was terrible. I was hurting and my mouth was wired shut, and I couldn't eat. Only things that went through my straw, through my teeth, which the attack actually really separated my teeth really bad. So I did have a lot of spaces. About 3 weeks after the attack, Mama took me to an oral surgeon in Miami. He decided that my jaw was not aligned correctly, so they had to re-break my jaw again after 3 weeks of healing. He put pins in each joint in my jaw, and then he had to wrap my chin with wire because there wasn't enough bone there to heal. So now I have two pins and wire wrapped around my chin. And I'm back home recuperating. I was about 6 weeks total of my mouth being wired. And as I sat there and thought and tried to heal, I heard the name Ted Bundy. I didn't know who that was. That was, you know, I was a freshman in college. I was, you know, I was happy, you know, carefree. And, you know, what's Ted Bundy? And as the reports on the television came through that he was actually arrested in Pensacola and taken back to Tallahassee to be as a prime suspect for the attacks, I started learning a little bit more about him. And it was something I needed to know. I needed to have the information, and I wanted it so bad. I wanted to know who he was. What kind of person does this? So I found, I read books, the first one being Ann Rule's book, The Stranger Beside Me, and it told a lot about him as a flesh and blood and bones and, you know, a person that he was. So I found that very interesting, and it helped heal me too, because it wasn't just this black bulb that I was afraid of. It was a person. I also started feeling that I was afraid of men. Men I didn't know, unfamiliar men, were terrifying me, actually, at that point. My mouth was unwired, and about 2 weeks later, I went and got a job at a lumber yard in South Miami. my mindset on that was I wanted to see the most men I could see in a given time at somewhere where I'm not comfortable, not in my space I'm usually in. And I wanted to work there and see them. And I worked maybe a month, and I was a cashier, so I would see everyone I could see, all the guys, until finally I said, you know, I'm over this now. I know, you know, there were a lot of men that came through, and you know, I didn't feel like they were going to hurt me or attack me. And I learned one thing though: there's a lot of cute construction workers out there, because it was a fun place to work for a while. So Mama decided, and I decided I didn't need to work and do that anymore. I went home and tried to recuperate some more. I still had bad feelings inside. I was afraid of things. Just things kind of spooked me. And I didn't like that. And I knew I wanted to get away. I wanted to get away from this feeling. So in my mind, I never saw a psychiatrist or a therapist back then. It's just something that wasn't offered. And we didn't. Where do you want to start?
I'm sorry, listeners, but I messed up. I stopped the recording by accident. You were talking about, you had left the lumberyard, you were back with your mom.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. After the time at the lumberyard, I was feeling good about myself that I overcame something. Mm-hmm. I still had this feeling of dread, like this black thing encompassed me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get away from that. And I had a goal. My goal, I could see in way out in the distance, was a little island. And that island had one tall palm tree and one little chair that sat in the sand. And that's all that was on it. And I wanted to get to that island so bad. And I thought that would be something that would free me, or something that if that island could help, I'd find something else I needed to get to get away from this. And I took baby steps. Yeah. And I took baby steps. And as I did that, I turned around, and this big black thing was baby steps behind me. Mm. And it took me a while. It took me a long while to do these baby steps in my head. And as I got closer to the island, that thing was closer behind me. It got further and further. By the time I reached my island and sat in the chair and put my toes in the sand, I looked and it was gone. I couldn't see it anymore. And that was to the ending of me being in that state of mind. Well, I can't come out of this. I'm going to live like this. No, I can do this. And my strength comes from within. I think knowing that you have a strength helps you, and everybody has a strength inside you. If you look really hard and deep inside you and you pull it up, and that strength is yours now, no one can take it away from you. And I used that strength to wrap me like a blanket. And when I needed to do something, that strength helped me get through that. It took a while, and I used it for different things, but mentally and physically, I could see it and feel it and do better because of it. So that is one thing. I enjoyed having the strength now. I could do this. So that's one thing that helped me. But after I recuperated, and after that big blob went away, I was married 6 months after the attack in June of 78. And I didn't know him very well. I knew him for about a year in college. And my mom and his parents thought that, oh, they should get married, you know, she needs someone to take care of her. And that marriage didn't last. It only lasted a couple years, but it wasn't something I needed at that point. I was letting people make decisions for me, and that I needed to make my own decisions. And I don't think anyone I had married at that point would have made it through a marriage just because of mentally where I was and how I needed to be on my own as far as getting better and healing. Mm-hmm. This was a rough time. Something else that I have in my heart is that I want to get better, not just for me, but for others around me, for my loved ones. They put as much effort into trying to help me as I was putting effort in trying to heal. And they were there doing anything and everything they could. I felt bad that I was, you know, their hassle, or, you know, and they said, no, you're, you know, we'd love to do things. And then I found out that if they asked to do something like turn on the light, and I say, no, I'll get it. And no, you do it for me. And they turned it on like, wow, we did something. Mm-hmm. So when someone is trying to help you, if you give them a little task or something they want to do, even though you can do it yourself, it really helps that person. And it made me feel good. Part of my recuperating and healing and doing things is I want other people to feel good around me. I don't want to bring them down. So I was looking to do and see who I was now. At this point, what was my life going to be like? A couple years after that, I had a baby. And my son is now 38. His name is Michael. But when I was diagnosed with lupus, there were things that they told me I should not do or should not have emotions, traumatic emotions, which I got attacked after I was diagnosed with lupus, and also that I shouldn't have children because that the hormones and everything in that situation activates lupus again, and it can come back so much more severe the second time than it did the first. A couple years after, during my marriage, I did get pregnant and had my little baby boy. I remember my mama said, no, you're going to have a baby. Oh my gosh, you're going to kill yourself. She had spent so much time and energy getting me healthy from lupus that she thought, okay, now. But I had a beautiful baby boy, and he was 2 when I got divorced, which I was a single mom for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. That was a time where I needed to grow, and he needed to grow, obviously. And it was a good time for both of us. It wasn't easy all the time, mm-hmm. but together we got through it. I didn't have to do it alone. I wanted to do it with him.
Let me ask you a question. When did you actually have to go and see Ted Bundy face to face in the courtroom?
I had to go see Bundy 1 year after the attack. The attack was January of 78. He was in the courtroom in June of 79. Mm-hmm. But before I had to go to trial, my deposition and my grand jury was in Tallahassee. So I was flown to Tallahassee. And during my deposition, it was like a huge conference room with a big conference table. When I walked in, there was attorneys for the prosecution and also for the defense. And at the end of the table was Ted Bundy. And I was standing up at the other end of the table, and I looked at him, and I sat down, and I looked at him, and he was just really smug looking. He just, you know, he had his face in his hand, his chin, and he was just looking at me smugly. And I looked at him, and I wasn't really afraid. Mm-hmm. I was just like, darn you. Why did you do this? You know? And it wasn't a fear. It was like facing him finally after all the thoughts I had in my head all this time. And, you know, a year later, it was like I'm getting to see. And, you know, it's not that he's not got the power over me.
Right.
And I did not take my eyes off of him the whole time.
Did you have anger built up?
I had anger, and it wasn't so much for me, because I was okay. I was getting through it. But my anger, was for the other women that he killed. All the young women that he took and killed and mutilated, and all their families that lost their beautiful children. He took them away from the world, from all of us so soon that just, I was angry for that. I was just really in a bad place thinking about that. And again, it wasn't for me because I knew I was going to be okay. It was for them. It's the voices that couldn't be seen and heard at that point and couldn't say what they wanted to him. Right. I don't remember what the questions were that I was asked by the both sides. And then it was my turn to leave, and I just got up and walked out.
For anyone living under for anyone living under a rock, I don't think we even like talked about who Ted Bundy really was before we started the pod. But Ted Bundy was a serial killer. So when she says, you know, he killed these women and mutilated them, he did. And I don't remember how many victims he had, but it was quite a many.
Yeah, it's up to 30. Right. He confessed to.
Right. And that one, was it just one that was a child?
No, he actually, I think there were one or two out in on the West Coast. And I think one was his, like in her, like she was 14. But all of them were in their teens.
Right. All of them were young girls. Right.
They were college students. And, you know, back then in the early 70s, it was kind of a freer society as far as, you know, how people acted and treated. So he was not ever thought of scary or anything. He had a baby boy face. He was really, you know, a cute looking guy at that point. And he would wear a cast or say he needed help to do something, and the women would go help him, and then he would abduct them and put them in his car and take them and kill them.
I'm sorry I kind of backed you up, because I felt like maybe the listeners would want to know how you felt in that moment, you know, and you know what I mean? Like, kind of like a few little details. But if you want to, we can, since you just, you know, touched on the subject, we can kind of go back to the moment where you were talking about your son and go from there. And because I know you're a breast cancer survivor too.
Yes, I am. Right after the deposition, the trial was in June of 70. I lived in Miami with my parents, so we went to the courthouse the day of my testimony. We didn't go during any of the trial, just my day. And I remember I woke up in the morning and I thought, oh God, this is going to be a bad day. But I looked in my closet and I found the brightest red dress with a white collar that I could find, and my pantyhose and my black shoes, and I was ready for court. And I didn't want to feel, you know, cowering and putting my head down. I wanted to stand up and show my red dress and have that feeling of confidence that I really wanted to have. We went to the courtroom, and it was really with the cameras and the TV feeds, reporters. It was the first trial that actually was done in court where the TV crew and everything could be in. So, at that point, I got to see him again. It was my turn to testify. I went in and sat at the testimony in the witness box. And I looked around the room. I could see the jurors on one side. And then I looked and I saw the prosecuting attorneys. I looked a little more and the defense table. And right there was Bundy. He was sitting across from me again in the courtroom, and I don't remember seeing anything else, because when I saw him, my eyes just locked on his. And this time he didn't look so smirky. He didn't have that, you know, confident little look. He was a little bit more subdued. His demeanor was quieter. Just, I could tell that in his face and his eyes. And he always had dark eyes. I don't know if I mentioned that. They weren't like black eyes. They were just like really dark. And I could not have told what color they were. They just unhappy eyes, or they just, that's the way I saw them. And this time I had more confidence. This time I was on the right side of good. I was in a place where I was I was going to help put him away, and that's what was important to me. Mm-hmm. And after the case, he was found guilty and sentenced to death.
Yeah.
And that would not take place actually until 1989. So it was about 10 years that he was on death row going through stays of execution.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it was a couple years later that I was, now I'm afraid of hospitals. That was another thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because of so many experiences in the, in lupus and going to the hospital, I was afraid of hospitals. After a while, I ended up going and getting a job at a hospital because I couldn't even walk through the front door. And so I worked there for 18 years, and it was the best job I ever had. And, you know, I was proudly walking through the front door after about a week because it's something that I controlled. It was my destiny to go through that door. So, so that's what I did. After couple years, I was married then now to my husband Scott, and we were going to have a baby, so I went to have a GYN doctor appointment, and they found a lump in my breast, and I hadn't felt it. And you know, he goes, well, don't you do self-exams? I'm like, well, no, you know, I just never thought about it. You hear people say do it, and if you don't do it, you don't find things. So they found the lump, and it was the size of a pea. So by the time we ended up doing the surgery, it had grown to the size of a walnut. And I was going to have a radical mastectomy. And if needed, they would take the other breast. But at that point, we didn't do it just, you know, just because it might come back. So I had a radical mastectomy. And that means they took the lymph nodes out of my arm and took out my breast. So it was just the flat material. It was just a flat side. And I did do tissue expanders,
mm-hmm.
which is when they put a balloon basically under your breast and they pump it up so that when you're ready to have final surgery for your reconstruction, that it's a size where you can go ahead and put the implant in. When I was diagnosed with the cancer, they said I had to have chemo as one of the ways to treat me. And in my head, it exploded. And I said, anything but chemo, no chemo, because it took me right back to that little kid in seventh grade that had no hair and just was horrible. It was a horrible memory. But I had to have 9 months of chemo. And I remember taking the first chemo and coming out and saying, wow, I have another chemo. I have one more chemo. And my husband's like, no, you have 8 more. I'm like, no, I have 1 more. And after that, I have 1 more. Because if I knew I had to take 7 or 8 or 9 more chemos, I couldn't do it. But I can do 1 more. And that's how I got through that stage of my life where I had to go through chemo again. And I just put it in my head, this is the way I'm doing it. I can't control not doing it, but I control how I do it. And doing one at a time really worked for me. It kind of made my little baby steps work for me again. So after the after my chemo, year or so later, I got pregnant, and Scott and I wanted to have another child. And about 3 weeks into the pregnancy, I had a miscarriage. And this broke me up so bad, because everything I've been through, I could do it. I could fix myself. I could be okay mentally. And I couldn't help this baby. I couldn't do anything to help it. And it was hard on me. And I know there's so many women out there who go through mastectomies, and then they go through miscarriages, and then everyone goes through things. And I just took it very personally that I couldn't help the baby, and it was very traumatic for me. About 6 months later, I got pregnant again, and this was a joyous time until the second trimester, and I miscarried again. And now I'm thinking, you know, this, I can't do this anymore. I can't feel like this and feel guilty that I did something and I couldn't save the baby. So we decided not to have any kids, and we went out and bought a sailboat. And that became my new baby, because Scott and I and Mike, which is now about 10 or 12, we would go sailing every weekend, and it became a fun experience for us. And we never thought about the miscarriages. You never forget, but it wasn't at the forefront of my mind anymore. It was, you know, that was that, and this is now, and I'm going to enjoy every minute of life now.
Right. You know, I take away from what you say, we've been knowing each other now for what, about, I'd say about 4 months.
Yes.
We have spoke over the phone pretty intimately about all these things, really, before we ever recorded. But I take what you say, and it just, the survivor in me feels a connection with the survivor in you. No matter what we survive, whether it be domestic violence, sexual assault, or just a violent crime like what you survived, and then the lupus, you know, being sick. I too suffer with lupus. So, I feel like we sort of have that connection. And, you know, I've never had a miscarriage, but I've only been able to have one child, because I have a female disorder. So, you know, it's like this, you're a true super survivor, you're a thriver. You know, you find the strength in the depths of who you are, you pick up and you move on. And essentially, that's what it's about. It's about survival. This podcast speaks to a lot of survivors and to a lot of victims of violent crimes, of domestic violence, and so on. And I want you to leave them with a message before we hang up the podcast, and tell them what you got going on also at the end. But we've got a few more minutes that we can talk before we have to hang up. So, okay. Yeah, just leave them with a few words.
Okay. One thing that I did know and I felt in my heart was Bundy took me on his journey. He took me into the depths of hurt and hell, and he was taking me somewhere on his journey. And I decided, no, I did not want my life to be determined and defined as a victim of Ted Bundy. I took his journey and I made it my own. And I just totally put him away from that. And I went on my own journey in life and faced what I had to face and enjoyed all the wonderful times. But I just, one thing that I found helped me is to put it behind you as best as you can and as healthy as you can. But know, whatever journey someone put you to go through, that just turn it into your journey and make that through life as something you want to do. And hopefully you can go forward as I have, and just with a very good outlook on life, because things get better. I used to say, you got to keep running because God's going to put a hurdle in front of you. And now I always say, you have to walk really fast and open the door, because it's going to be a hurdle in front of you, but look behind it, because it's always going to be something good. So that's the way I live life now. I just want to see what's ahead of me and enjoy whatever it is.
And you are working, and you are working on.
Yes, I just started the last month or so writing a book, and I've had so many people say that I should write about myself and you know, tell what I've been through. And I've always felt like this is just my little life, and you know, I'm very thankful and pleased that people want to hear about it. So basically, I've been talked into writing a book, although for all these years I've written like little things that I don't want to forget and things I want to remember. So I'm very excited. I hear it takes a couple years or a year or two to write a book. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm still on the stage of getting everything together that I want to talk about and write about that people have found interesting.
Yeah.
So I appreciate all that. And also I'm on Twitter. If anyone wants to contact me, they can find me there, and you know, I can respond back. And if you have any special questions or anything you need more information about, I'd be happy to talk with you.
Yeah. She's on Facebook too. Do not stalk her though. If you hit her, I'm not just kidding, but for real. She is a very open and honest human being. And a very lovely one, I shall say. And, Kathy, I'm so happy you come on the podcast. I'm sorry I messed us up, but hopefully it'll work out.
Well, let me know if it doesn't, and I will be more than happy to talk to you again. Or if there's anything that you get feedback on, like I said, that if people want to know more about my story, if they, you know, ask you to talk to me again, I'd be more than happy.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I really appreciate it. And thank you for all of the storytelling. I mean, it was just very riveting. And I told her when we took our break a while ago, I felt like I was in the room with her and Bundy, and I wanted to hurt him and I wanted to save her life and I wanted to save her from the pain. So I'm sure that all of you got the same feeling. I know you did. Truly, I appreciate you so much. And I want to say thank you to all the listeners out there, and just love yourself and, you know, take care of yourself. And if you are in a domestic violence situation or a violent situation, please seek help. A safety plan is the best way out. I always preach that. But guys, thank you for all the love and support with the podcast and what I do on social media. And look Kathy up. She is on Twitter. She's on social media. And, you know, her book's coming soon, so maybe it'll be out in another year. So anyway, love you guys, and I will see you on the next podcast. Bye. Hey guys, I just wanted to make a quick little bit of audio for you. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so with the actual app. You can go on to the website and there's a button there. It says sponsorship of the app of the podcast, and there's all different types, you know, from 99 cents a month to maybe $10 a month. I mean, if you want to do that, that's fine. You don't have to. This is a free podcast. Y'all all know that. If you would like to donate to the podcast, it would really be appreciative. Your donations go toward keeping the podcast moving. So if you want to hear more episodes like the one that you just heard, donate now to the Money Sign Survivor Podcast 43. That's a cash out that was set up just for the podcast in mind. Every little bit helps. And so just be the first one to donate. And whoever would like a shout out, if you donate to the podcast, I will give you a shout out in the next podcast. May just do an entire podcast dedicated to the people who do want to donate and sponsor the podcast. So appreciate it. And my email is hmisty387@gmail.com. If you happen to donate or anything like that, it'll pop up in my email, so I'll know your name. But if you want to personally email me, you can do that too. So thank you guys for the love and support, and I look forward to talking to you on the next podcast. Bye, guys.